Welcome to the History Nerds United podcast. I'm your head nerd, Brendan. Thank you so much for being here. Today we have author Henry Hemming in his book, Four Shots in the Night, a true story of spies, murder, and justice in Northern Ireland. Okay, so this has to do with a murder in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. If you don't know about the Troubles, there is no way for me to sum it all up in 60 seconds and do it any real justice. But basically, Ireland got independence. The Republic of Ireland was created. Northern Ireland, just kind of the northern, northeastern tip of Ireland, stayed with the UK. A lot of times what you hear, it was Protestants versus Catholics. It's not nearly that simple. It wasn't necessarily a religious thing. It just ended up being that if you were on the Protestant side, you were probably pro-British. If you were Catholic, you were on probably the pro-Irish side. Again, you could do 100 episodes on the Troubles and not get everything in there, but those are just the basics, so you can kind of understand what Henry and I are talking about. We'll do more on this. The Troubles is something that I've always found very interesting, being a descendant of a lot of Irish people. So something to look into. Really interesting conversation with Henry on this. We dive into all of this stuff, but especially this murder. This book is great. Let me shut up. Let's get to Henry. And here we are with author Henry Hemming, Four Shots in the Night, a true story of spies, murder, and justice in Northern Ireland. Henry, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Brendan. Really good to be here.
So, Henry, before we get started, I just have to, this is amazing to me because you must have just a really fun household because you are married to another fantastic author, Helena Merriman, who, Tunnel 29, one of my favorite books as well. How does that work having, you know, two really well-known authors? Do you kind of sit there and it's, oh, hey, I sold 4,000 books today, but you sold only 3,500. You're doing the dishes. Is that kind of how it works?
There are times when it can feel like that. It's really nice. And I feel like, you know, of course he would say that. It is nice because we talk shop. We talk about stories and how to shape things and where things are going wrong. And look, she is a brilliant, brilliant editor. She's got a fantastic creative sense of how to shape a story. So if things are ever not working out with a particular thing I'm trying to work on, she's a brilliant set of eyes to pass it on to. Does it ever get competitive? I don't think it does because we got to the stage where we're so invested in each other's stuff. It often feels, I wouldn't say they all feel like collaborations, but they certainly feel like joint ventures. But hey, maybe that could change at any point.
Well, what I do find interesting is her books and your books, and especially this one, you're dealing with stories where people may not want all of it to come out. I have to feel like it's nice to have somebody who understands that part of being an author, right? If you're a fiction author, you're writing what you want to write. But when you're writing these types of books where the subjects may actively not want to speak with you, it's kind of got to be nice to have somebody who understands those frustrations, right?
Totally. And at the same time, this book that I've been writing recently, Four Shots in the Night, feels different to anything I've done in the past, and also Helena's book, Tunnel 29. And it's different because so many more of the people involved were not only caught up in something more contemporary, but also so many of them had a greater reason not to speak, exactly as you said. So what that meant was that the research process was always going to be totally different. It was going to be longer, for one, because trust was going to be at the heart of this. And it sometimes takes a long time to develop trust enough that someone's going to speak to you for a book that you're writing. I mean, there was one interview, which I'm not going to describe in detail, but one interview which played a huge part in Four Shots in the Night, where it took me 2 years to set this up. And that required, yeah, a lot of patience and a lot of trying to think around the problem and also accepting that, you know, this thing might never happen. So in that sense, it was a totally different kind of book to think about and to prepare. And I learned a hell of a lot in terms of how you can research a story that's more contemporary, that's more contentious, and one in which the stakes are so much higher.
And now before we even talk about the direct subject, we are talking about something that happened during Troubles of Northern Ireland. And you deal with this right away in the book where you say you're kind of an outsider, even though you are British. I'm not going to hold that against you. But that's going to be a huge thing, too, that when you're about to kind of step into this, did you feel comfortable stepping into this? Or did you look at this and say, there are going to be people who may not want to hear from me just because of my nationality?
Totally. It's, as you say, a big issue. And the first thing I realized is I could not just jump into this and just start telling the story. I had to address roughly who I am, roughly where I'm coming from. And I think with all the other books I've written, a lot of the more recent ones, they've been about Second World War stories, where you don't always have to spell out, I'm not on the side of the Nazis. You kind of, it's almost implied roughly where you're coming
Hopefully.
From. Yeah. And with this, I began to think, hey, I'm just going to be impartial. I'm just going to be neutral. That's going to be my position. But very quickly, just as I began to do the research process, I began to speak to people. And the first question everyone asked was, where are you coming from? What's your angle? What's your position? And initially, I remember sort of feeling, well, that's, I don't have one. I'm an outsider. But that's not true. And I've grown up in Britain. I've grown up in London. I went to an Anglican school. I've grown up familiar with Northern Ireland, but also feeling like it's a lot further away than it actually is. All of these things contribute roughly to any kind of prejudice that I might have. But I also came to understand that the only way I was going to be able to do this and make this story work and come alive was not to try and be impartial, but to be the opposite, to try and be partial to a Martin McGuinness, partial to a Gerry Adams, but also partial to a senior British army officer, and also partial to someone like Frank Hegarty, who becomes recruited by the British army, who is an Irish Catholic. In other words, I had to invest myself as fully as possible in these different perspectives. And that was the only way really to try and make sense of it.
And, you know, right even before we hit record on this, we talked just for a second, but I loved how you kind of said they're all kind of sinners and saints in a little bit, that no matter who you look at in this book, they're not going to be completely clean. They're not going to be completely dirty either.
Totally. And you know what? The moment you say that, there's one figure who immediately comes to mind. And he turned out to be one of the main characters in Four Shots in the Night. And that is Martin McGuinness. And I don't know how much your listeners will know about McGuinness, but I didn't know enough about him when I came into this story. And having now spent about 4 years learning about him, about his achievements, about some of the things that he did, he's the most unusual character I've ever tried to write about. And here's the reason why. He was capable of things that were, I think for want of a better phrase, extremely bad, but also extremely good. He was responsible for a large number of murders, for savage brutality. And at the same time, he did more than almost anyone else within Sinn Féin to bring peace to the region. And as a politician, he did things that were exceptionally brave in order to try and maintain that fragile peace, which came about in the wake of the Good Friday Agreement. It's really difficult to try and write about someone like that, because most of the people that we hear about, not just in history books, but just in life, in the news, in the world, most of these people are portrayed to us as generally pretty good or pretty bad. And to have someone who's both, sometimes at the same time, is really confusing at first. And at the same time, we need to try and hold these contradictions. This man was a paradox. And I think just because he was a paradox, that doesn't mean we shouldn't try and address who he was and what he did. So he was a fascinating person to write about. And like I say, unlike anyone else I've tried to encounter in my short career.
What was the spark for you that you felt you needed to write this book? Was it finding out about, who we'll talk about, Steak Knife? Was it just the troubles and you started looking for a story within it? What was your entry point?
It was a conversation. And at the time, I had a different book in my mind. I had it all lined up. I had a proposal sketched out. I was about to tell my agent, this is what I want to write next. And then I spoke to somebody who said, what's the effect of, you do realize that the biggest story in the history of British intelligence from the last 70 years is spies inside the IRA. And I hadn't heard that. And I did not know that. And I was skeptical at first. I thought, this guy's just exaggerating. He doesn't know the full picture, perhaps. But I began to look more into it. I began to have conversations with people who had personal experiences of working in Northern Ireland, or people who lived in Northern Ireland. And I began to realize there was an extraordinary story here, one which hadn't fully been told. And as I began to dig more into it, I kept coming back to this story of Frank Hegarty and the story of this one particular murder. And there was a moment fairly soon after that when I realized that this one murder really encapsulates everything that was going on in terms of intelligence and Northern Ireland. And this extraordinary idea, which I remember hearing early on in my research, that the reason the Troubles ended when they did was not just the negotiation of Tony Blair and Alistair Campbell and people like that around the Good Friday Agreement. It might have been actually something else. It might have been the fact that the IRA was so infiltrated with undercover agents by that point that it was not able to function as a military unit in the way that they had hoped. And at the same time, and this is something which has not been written about a great deal, there were so many agents inside Sinn Féin or close to Sinn Féin that allowed Sinn Féin to become a viable political force. So that these two different factors might have played a much bigger part in ending this conflict than anything else that we like to consider. And when I got my head around that, I realized, okay, this is really interesting. Because if you take five steps back and you look at just the history of conflicts around the world, I don't think you can point to a single one in which you can say spies played a decisive part in bringing this to an end. And I think what drew me into this story is the possibility that spies could have played this pivotal role in bringing the Troubles to an end. So it was that combination of things. It was finding out about Frank Hegarty, understanding the role that spies might have played, which came together and really triggered my curiosity. And yeah, that's where it all began.
I think there are so many things that would be hard with a book like this, but just giving that introduction to the IRA, Sinn Féin, the Troubles, that's Herculean. Like, you could write volumes of books just on the Troubles, just on the IRA and how the IRA, because the IRA is not just one thing. You know, there's provisional IRA and all of that stuff, which I think you do a great job explaining that. So somebody, you know, I grew up, you know, coming from Irish Catholic stock, so I've heard a lot about this growing up. But for somebody who didn't know, there's a lot of ground to cover, isn't there?
Yeah, there's so much. And in a similar way, I've spent most of my life in Britain, most of it in London. I thought I knew a certain amount. I didn't. I had to educate myself a great deal. And maybe that's an advantage. Maybe if you're coming to it relatively fresh, you're more open to some of the surprising elements of it. And perhaps it's easier then to describe it without too much jargon or without assuming too much knowledge on the part of the reader. I guess there were a series of things that really surprised me about the Troubles, which I hadn't really understood. Number one, I hadn't taken on board the extent to which it began not as a campaign for the unification of Ireland, but it began as a civil rights campaign, that it started out as people inspired by what was going on in the US and people marching through the streets of Derry, people campaigning throughout Northern Ireland, as I say, not for unification, but for equal rights and simply asking for the right to vote, the same right to housing and the same right to jobs. And we're talking here just about discrimination against Catholics living in Northern Ireland. That was the issue which started it all off. And I guess the Troubles made more sense to me when I thought of it in these three fairly distinct phases, that it begins as a civil rights campaign. And you have Catholics with some Protestants marching together. They're mostly youthful. They're idealistic. They're trying to fight discrimination. And then it becomes something else. It becomes a more sectarian conflict in which you have a more tribal set of divisions coming out, basically Catholics versus Protestants. And then the British Army turns up and suddenly you've got this totally different dimension to the whole conflict. And then the question is, how do we get them out? And then it becomes much, much more about unification. Should this part of the island remain part of Britain or become part of Ireland? Yeah, well, once I kind of broke it down into those three separate phases, it became a little bit easier to understand. And those three phases, obviously, you know, they come together, they mingle. It's messy. It's never just one thing or the other. But usually those three things are present in most parts of this 30-year conflict.
Now, one of the things that, well, actually, the kind of everything revolves around is that there are Irish Catholics willing to work with British intelligence. And I thought it was very interesting how you present this, of why somebody who, for all intents and purposes at this time in the world, should hate anything and everything British Protestant, but that there were people willing to work with British intelligence. What would be the reasons at this point in history that you're looking at that they might be willing to do that? Because it seems like this story happens right at a bit of a sea change about the way things were going during the Troubles.
Yeah, there are so many reasons. But I mean, I'll throw up some of the things that came up during the research for Four Shots in the Night. I think one of the first things to say is that for someone like the character at the heart of this book, Frank Hegarty, who's an Irish Catholic from Derry, some of the hatred, some of the animosity that he might have had was directed towards Protestants in the region, and especially paramilitary Protestants in the region. But it was really interesting for me to understand that the way he would see the army, and often when I say the army, I mean guys from Liverpool, from Yorkshire, from Essex, people who've come over to Northern Ireland, they don't know the territory, they speak in a different way, they're outsiders. And I think it's really significant that when one of these people approaches someone like Frank, they're not necessarily the enemy. They're certainly strange and foreign, and he knows that in theory he should not be speaking to them, but they don't have that same immediate sense of being a threat. And there were certainly, for many Irish Catholics, it often became easier to speak to someone who was a complete outsider like that, as opposed to someone who was from a Protestant Ulster community. Or, you know, to use the language that someone in Derry would understand, it's easier to speak to someone who comes from across the water, not from across the street. So that sort of began to unlock what was going on. I think the other thing to remember is that a lot of people who were, let's say, Catholic, living in Northern Ireland, not all of them supported the IRA. Not all of them wanted the IRA to succeed and wanted them to continue. At every opportunity that they had to go to the polls, the Sinn Féin was outperformed by the SDLP. In other words, the people who were pushing for a non-violent solution to the Troubles. And the SDLP was absolutely open in its condemnation of the IRA and of Sinn Féin. And I think that's really significant. But getting beyond that, getting beyond the kind of who you vote for in the polling booth, there were often times when IRA attacks went wrong. In other words, you could have someone like Frank, who might feel a really powerful need for revenge against the IRA. It could be that a friend of his, a cousin, someone he knows very well, had been killed by the IRA, either by intention or by mistake. It could be that they were the victim of a so-called punishment attack or punishment beating, something like that. So there could be some kind of personal reason for wanting to get back at the IRA. But then you've got the other reasons that people become agents. It can also be to do with money. So someone might have fallen on hard times. Maybe they've got a mortgage they want to pay off. Maybe they're in debt. Maybe they've got a gambling problem. If someone comes to you and they say they can solve that problem straight away, they can make it just go away, that's really attractive. So money can play a big part in it. And I think from a distance, when you hear the idea that someone becomes an agent for financial reasons, immediately you think they're greedy. You know, they're trying to kind of squirrel away a whole lot of money so they can get rich and run away and live at some luxurious lifestyle. But what we're talking about instead is alleviating poverty, alleviating some kind of debt, which might have accrued somewhere along the line. You've also got blackmail. So there might be, for someone like Frank Hegarty, there might be something in his private life that the British have found out about. Maybe he's having an affair with someone and the British find out about it, and they can blackmail him into becoming an agent for them. So that's also one of the lines in. And I guess the other thing that's really good to remember is just the possibility that someone like Frank, he's inspired by all sorts of different things, but one of them is a desire to bring this to an end. It's a feeling that this has gone on for too long, and that if he doesn't act, maybe it's just going to continue for the rest of his life. It's having kids, it's wanting them to grow up in a more peaceful place, even if it's not politically the one that he envisages, even if it means Northern Ireland is still part of the UK. For some people, the main thing was trying to end the violence after it had been going on for so long. And maybe just the last thing I'll throw in, because it's certainly in Four Shots in the Night, it was something that really surprised me. It's something that I hadn't anticipated. And this is just the role of friendship. And the role of having a handler who gets on with his agent, someone who has shared interests, someone who doesn't look down on him, doesn't look up to him either, but sees him eye to eye. And for some people, if they reach a point in their life where, let's say nobody else is taking them seriously, let's say at home they're being belittled, they're not feeling important, and suddenly here comes someone who takes them seriously, who speaks to them like an equal, who makes them feel wanted, who offers themselves as a friend, sometimes that can be attractive. And sometimes that can be enough to allow someone to just consider the idea of working for the Brits, as they were usually known.
And especially around this time, this was all consuming in certain parts of Northern Ireland where everyone felt it. It was a thing that you dealt with on a daily basis. And you explained this too when we're talking about it. You know, somebody like Frank may have something in his background that would make him prepared for this, but intelligence could come from anywhere. You could just be somebody who walks the certain route that the British intelligence might want a little bit more information on, which means it felt like it was a battlefield and everyone was part of it, whether or not they wanted to be.
You're absolutely right. The territory we're looking at often would feel like an enormous battlefield. And that's a strange thing for anyone like Frank Hegarty, to feel like the world they've known for so much of their life as being peaceful is suddenly a battlefield. And I think there's something about the way in which the British Army controlled so much of this territory that could make it feel like less of a dangerous thing to do, to be speaking to these soldiers. In other words, if they present themselves as people who are basically in charge, it's simpler to speak to them. It's not like they're entering hostile territory. So that also plays a small part in the decision to agree to speak to these people.
Now, a very important part of this is basically, and well, listen, we're talking about spies, there's going to be a hit squad. And in this particular book, it's called the Nutting Squad, which, yes, that name has not aged well. But can you tell me more about the Nutting Squad?
Absolutely. So, official name, Internal Security Unit. And this is part of the IRA. But it's part of the new version of the IRA that comes about in the late 1970s. So, up until then, just to kind of summarize this big, big shift within this organization. Up until then, most of the IRA top brass have been saying, right, this year, boys, we're going to do it. We're going to drive the Brits out of Northern Ireland. We're going to unify the island. Every time that didn't happen, obviously, there's a sense of disappointment. But the following January, they'd say, okay, let's go again. Martin McGuinness and Gerry Adams and some others like Ivor Bell, they began to formulate this new approach, which they called the Long War Strategy. To sum it up in football terms, it's the idea of not really going all out for a victory, but it's playing for a draw. And the idea is this new version of the IRA under the new Long War Strategy would become smaller, become leaner, become more professional, and basically you'll be able to keep going for a longer period of time. The more they thought about it, they realized, okay, this is, you know, this sounds good in theory, but it's only going to work if we can make sure that the IRA has no spies whatsoever inside it. So we have to get better at removing spies from our midst. And it's around about that time that this new unit comes to life. Originally called the Internal Security Unit, it soon becomes known, as you say, as the Nutting Squad. And that's because to nut is to shoot someone in the head. So the Nutting Squads would be there to interrogate suspected informers or spies. And once they got a confession, if they got a confession, that would be sent to the IRA Army Council. And on that, you have people like Gerry Adams, Martin McGuinness, and then at least one person from the Army Council would have to make a decision. And they decide whether or not this person's going to be killed. By all accounts, most of the time, they were unforgiving. Most of the time, the suspected informer was then shot. And this murder would usually be at the hands of the same people who'd interrogated him. It would be the Nutting Squad who would take this person off and shoot them, kill them, and they'd be left out in a place where they could be found pretty much as an example to others. So a huge part of the Nutting Squad mythology was that they were terrifying, that you didn't want to get on the wrong side of them. And that was part of the strategy. You needed them to be terrifying. That would scare people off becoming spies. So to a small extent, some of the things that were said about the Nutting Squad were exaggerated. Certainly the amount of physical violence they used in terms of what they were doing in the interrogation, that was often exaggerated. The people who controlled the Nutting Squad for a lot of the 1980s, they usually, when they were doing interrogations, relied just on mental torture. In other words, just getting the person who's under suspicion to speak for as long as possible. And depriving them of sleep, sometimes depriving them of food and water, and just getting them to go over their story again and again and again and again, and looking for the smallest inconsistency. And that was one of the techniques that they developed. The main thing that most people who've heard of the Nutting Squad will know today is that the second in command was somebody known as Steak Knife. And this person who who appears a lot in the book, in Four Shots in the Night. This is someone who worked his way back into the IRA after being kicked out, and he later became a senior figure within the Nutting Squad, but at the same time, he was reporting to the British. And this becomes this extraordinarily morally complex situation in which the British are getting incredibly good, as in incredibly valuable intelligence from this source. But this source is also involved in abduction, in kidnap, in torture, and his alleged murder.
Now, when you're an author trying to get information about this, you started talking about this at the beginning of the podcast. You got to get a lot of time. You got to get a lot of trust. But even when you're talking about somebody like Gerry Adams, who will say that he was absolutely not a part of things that he clearly was part of, how long does it take? Can you get that close? Is there anybody in this area that's really willing to kind of talk about this? I mean, I'm sure it's not on the record or anything like that, but how close were you able to get that you felt confident in the information that you were getting?
You know, it's a difficult question to answer because so many of the conversations I had were off the record. But I can openly and happily say that I was able to speak to people from across the complete spectrum of this story. So by that, I mean former IRA people, but I also mean people who used to serve in intelligence. But I also mean the people caught up in the middle. So people who were close to Frank Hegarty, people who lived in Derry at the time. I've spoken to people who were in the police. I've spoken to people who were on the Protestant side of it. As I say, a multiplicity of viewpoints. And I think the thing that surprised me was that if you're completely honest about where you're coming from, by the fact that you're writing a book, and you're open about who you are and roughly what your viewpoint is going to be, I think most people will be willing to speak off the record. And this was certainly my experience when I was researching this book. And at the same time, of course, there are some people who won't. And I totally respect that and appreciate that. But I think, I mean, to get to like the core of your question, the scale of this story, in other words, the number of people who are involved in the business of running agents in Northern Ireland during the Troubles is so large that there will always be someone who's willing to talk to you. It's worth talking for a moment about numbers. And there's an incredible moment happened about 15 years ago when somebody called Father Dennis Bradley, who's on the consultative group of the past, he was given access to classified information. And he was looking into the legacy of some of the things that happened during the Troubles. And he saw in one of these documents a detail of just how many undercover agents were being run by either the British police or MI5 or the British Army during the Troubles. And as he put it, there were at any one time 800 undercover agents who were being run. And I mean, I found that amazing in itself. But the thing that also amazed me was the reaction to this comment from a former intelligence officer who apparently scoffed when he heard the number 800 and said, no, it was way more than that. Which is, I mean, when you think about that, let's say we're talking about 900 or maybe 1,000 undercover agents at any one time. The population of Northern Ireland is only 1.5 million. And it's a vast, vast number given the size of the population. So this is a huge endeavor. There are a lot of people who've been involved in it in some shape or form. And so it follows that there will be people who want to talk. There will be enough people who are able to give you insights into what happened. And once you piece everything together, it's possible to get a sense of roughly what was going on. And like I say, I found the scale of it truly astonishing.
It seems like, and between your book, you really talk about this, and I'm also thinking back to Patrick Radden-Keefe's Say Nothing. It seems like there's two types of people when you're talking about the Troubles nowadays. Those that want to say the past is the past, we're moving forward, and those who want justice, right? We're talking about a murder here, and yes, we're being very roundabout about it because we don't want to give everything away, but it seems like there is two very, very passionate people, types of people, that one wants it to go away and one wants people to answer for their crimes. Is that what you saw when you were starting these interviews, that people kind of fell into that dichotomy, or is there still a lot of nuance in between those?
It's a really interesting question. And most of the focus of my book has been on people who were caught up in the business of spying, but also the business of the IRA Nutting Squad murdering or abducting potential spies or people who have been accused of being spies. And the families of those victims, this is a thing that really caught me unawares, they're not always after justice. And there's a fascinating quote from the man who's led a police investigation into this. And he said that one of the things that surprised him, speaking to the families of victims of the Nutting Squad, is that often they were more interested in the truth than they were in justice. And the more I researched this book, the more I came to understand the distinction between the two. I think we're entering a stage now, and especially in terms of some of the laws that have been passed, maybe we can get into that later, but in terms of some of the laws that have been passed recently, we seem to be entering this new phase where there's less of a possibility for justice, and there's much more of a possibility for truth to come out. In other words, documents to be declassified, more information to come out about exactly what was going on, who was being run as a spy, who was involved in murders, etc. And from a historical point of view, I think that makes sense. And yes, you're absolutely right. There are some people who say the past is the past, but I'd say they're in a minority. And I'd say the majority of people would say that in order to move forward, you need to have a better understanding of what actually happened. And the worst thing you can do is to cover it up. And at the same time, and I don't want this to sound contradictory, in the early days of the peace, it needed to be covered up. In the early days of the peace, immediately after the Good Friday Agreement, I could understand the argument for not going into the past and for not trying to work out exactly what happened. And you'll find this, I mean, throughout the history of the world, when there is some kind of bitter civil war or some kind of internal conflict, and it's not clear who the victor is, where both sides come out of it and there's no one who's saying, right, we were in the right, everyone agrees, the other guys are in the wrong. When you come out of something like the Troubles, as the territory did in 1998, you're left with this different situation in which everyone agrees that in order to embrace the future, you need to set aside the past for now. And I think 25 years on, we're now reaching a stage where it is possible to talk more openly about exactly what happened. And there's going to be a report released very soon after we record this podcast, which will be the result of something called Operation Canova. And that's going to be a really good example of this. That's going to be a report which will lift the lid on what this agent Steak Knife did, but it's not going to lead to justice. It'll lead to a lot of truth, but it won't lead to a criminal result. I mean, no one's going to end up in jail as a result of what this report is going to say. And it's certainly my hope that this is part of a trend. It's certainly my hope that there can be more exposition, there can be more that's released, there can be more openness. And I certainly feel that that will help in terms of healing and in terms of people being able to move on.
Well, you mentioned them, the laws. What laws are you talking about and what are their intents?
There are two laws that have been passed in the last few years. One is to do with what an undercover agent is legally allowed to do. That was very much brought about by the investigation into Steak Knife. That's maybe less relevant. The other law, which is exactly what we're talking about, is far more controversial, and it will make it not so much illegal, but it will no longer be possible to bring about a criminal investigation concerning something that took place during the Troubles. In other words, there'll be a new statute of limitation, and that's now been passed. That was very controversial at the time, but it has gone through, and it looks as though it's, although it's being challenged, it looks as though it's going to stand the test of time. That will lead to one of the details in this law. It says there's going to be no more prosecutions for alleged criminality during the Troubles. But at the same time, there's going to be this new body. It's called the Independent Commission for the Recovery of Truth. And this will be essentially able to look behind the curtain, able to see classified information, and will be producing as much information as possible and putting it out there in the public domain. It's not going to be leading to prosecutions, but it's going to be leading to a lot more information being known about what took place during the Troubles. So I'd be really interested to see how this works, to see just how much actually comes out. There's a lot of skepticism. A lot of people think it's not going to produce as much information as people want. It won't satisfy that need for an understanding of what really took place. But I'm optimistic. I think they have a lot to prove. And I think there's certainly a chance that they could produce a lot of really powerful information that could help some of the healing that many people believe needs to happen.
And just to put a fine point on it, so if I know my neighbor Marty 30 years ago murdered my brother because he thought that he was a spy or whatever it is, this law basically says, even if I know that, even if he walks out and tells me and tells everyone and tells the TV camera, he can't be prosecuted for that because it was falls under the umbrella of the Troubles.
more or less. He's got to first of all agree to cooperate with this truth recovery body. And if he does, and they're totally satisfied that he's told them everything he knows, then essentially he has immunity. And I guess what's important to remember is that you already have a version of this. In other words, you have people who were in jail who were released after the Good Friday Agreement. So you have that situation in which Marty is walking the street and you know that Marty has committed a crime during the Troubles, but he's still there and you're seeing him in the supermarket every other day. And yeah, that can be really difficult. I think that's something which again is absolutely essential to understanding what the Troubles was. During this conflict, there are obviously people who were released after the Good Friday Agreement, who were let out of jail, but there are also a lot of people who got away with murder, quite literally, who carried out atrocities, and the police either were unable to investigate or in some cases not totally willing. And a lot of the time, the killer of a victim would be living in the same area as the family of the victim. And the family of the victim would see the person who's almost certainly killed their loved one on a regular basis. And I think when I began to understand that, it really brought home to me some of the savage intimacy of this conflict and just how close some of these relationships were. And certainly in the case of Frank Hegarty, someone who I've been talking about, this was a feature. I won't say any more, but this was, I think, an important part of understanding the legacy of what happened to him.
Now, I'm sure this is a different answer for somebody from Derry or something like that. For you, do you see the Troubles as in the rearview mirror for Northern Ireland? Is this something that is, for the most part, put to bed with these laws and everything like that? Or is this a situation where another spark and this can start all over again?
I don't for a moment think it's in the past and can just be put to bed. And at the same time, I don't believe that another spark could cause a return to the Troubles. And I think that takes me back to one of the points I was making right at the start. The reason this all began was due to a massive injustice in terms of the rights that Catholic Northern Irish men and women had. And that is to do with housing, that's to do with votes, that's to do with jobs. Most of that has gone. Most of that discrimination is no longer there. So there isn't that underlying injustice in the way that there absolutely was in the late 1960s. So I don't think you're going to have, I suppose, the kind of the seed for violence contained in that. At the same time, I think people's understanding and attachment to national identity has changed. And I think this is a broader, more international shift. Certainly in all of the polls that you read, when it comes to what young people in Northern Ireland believe today, they care less about whether Northern Ireland is part of the UK or is part of Ireland than their parents did when they were the same kind of age. It's less emotive as an issue. And that's partly also because of the reality of life in Northern Ireland today, which there is still a soft border. Even Brexit has not totally changed that situation. And so I don't think you have the preconditions for a second Troubles. But at the same time, what happened in the past does still need to be digested, does still need to be talked about, does still need to be brought out into the open. And only then can people truly begin to move on.
One of the reasons we started History Nerds is because a lot of people say nonfiction's not for me, although a lot of people do still like true crime. But this is true crime and it's history. It's twisty. It's not like you know who the killer is from day one or page one. If I sat one of those people in front of you and said, nonfiction's not for me, that's not interesting. History is a class I took in high school. This poor misguided person, what would you say to them if they said, why should I read Four Shots in the Night?
First of all, I'd say I totally understand where you're coming from. And after that, I'd say Four Shots in the Night, it's not a history book. It's the story of a murder. It's a mystery. And it will move you. It moved me. That's, I think, what I'd begin by saying. And then I'd march them off to the nearest bookstore. I don't think of it as a history book. I'm always excited by this moment where journalism meets history, where the recent past meets history as governed by historians. And this is one of these subjects that really kind of fits into that. I don't want to call it a no man's land, but it's in that kind of interesting place between history, between journalism. It's between true crime, it's between espionage. It's contemporary, but also a lot of it happened 30, 40 years ago. And I think that excites me. It excites me, finally, for one other reason, that this is something which matters to people today. This is not a distant problem or issue. This genuinely changes the way people think about themselves, think about the future, think about the place in which they live. that's why the stakes are higher. That's why it's more interesting. This is about people's lives today as much as it is about something which happened 40 years ago. And I think the thing that for me, the fact that there is this contemporary police investigation that runs through the book, that's the thing that kind of brings it up to speed for me. And so hopefully my short answer is, it's not a history book.
Well, Henry, I loved it no matter how you categorize it. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really kind.
And that's it for this episode. Henry, thank you so much. Four Shots in the Night. Great book, everybody. Go out and get it. I absolutely loved it. Think you will too. Hit us up, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Don't forget our new YouTube channel. Until next time, nerds, stay cool.
History Nerds United.